For the week of April 1st, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 143, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in my red room of pain, I'm Michael Giltz.
I have no idea what that is a reference to, although I'm going to speculate it is about one of our first stories, The 50 Shades of Grey.
That's right.
And now, have you read the book?
I have not.
You have not?
I'm not a middle-aged housewife.
You're not
a...
Okay. Well,
mommy porn is the term for this erotica, but tell people what it is.
Well, actually, that's one of the things we're going to be discussing on today's show. It's this steamy novel that has pretty much everyone in Hollywood talking. I guess you could say they're talking, or at the very least, opening their wallets because they've paid some big cash for it to turn it into a movie. But here's the thing. It began as fan fiction inspired by the Twilight books and has yet, I think tomorrow or the next day, is going to be published in paperback.
That's right.
Now, on today's show, we're also going to be talking about Spotify, which continues to make waves in the music world as they grow their ecosystem through numerous applications. Now, Michael, you might remember that on episode 135, we talked to Jonathan Handel. Do you remember that?
I do.
And we were talking to him about how the Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA might merge. Well, it looks like on Friday, they actually walked down the aisle and got hitched. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who apparently is in a lot of pain. He's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office around the world is Wrath of the Titans. First, they clashed, and now they're very angry about it. Wrath of the Titans is open to $112 million worldwide. It doubled or tripled, I think, its U.S. Opening overseas. It did really well around the rest of the world. At number two around the world is The Hunger Games, which grossed $96 million worldwide. It's at $365 million and counting.
In North America, it's like been out for what? 7-8 days already?
Well, more than that.
$250 million in the first 10 days. That's absolutely remarkable.
Right. And in contrast to Wrath of the Titans, it's not doing that well overseas. It's doing fine in English language territories, but the books are not the hot, red hot property that they are overseas. So it's doing not nearly as much business. That's how people portray it. But it's made over $100 million overseas. If it had made that much money in general, it would have been a pretty good hit. You know, so it's not doing poorly, just doing poorly in comparison to North America.
Well, it's a Lionsgate film. Is it open in all territories, or are they platforming it and rolling it out territory by territory?
Wrath of the Titans opened everywhere. The Hunger Games, I'm not as clear, but I think it's in a lot of the major territories. I think they opened it pretty quickly, but it's not easy to get a grasp on that, frankly. I don't know if you know of any good resource, but trying to figure out how many territories it's opened, how big they are, and how many it has to go. It's sort of a catch-as-catch-can movie by movie. You just have to depend on the trade papers like Hollywood Reporter or Variety to say, oh, this hasn't opened in Japan or China yet, or that hasn't opened here. So it's not an easy thing to get a beat on. I don't know about you. Is that true?
That's fairly true, yeah. I mean, you can maybe look on RentTrak and begin to piece it together. But when you see the Hollywood Reporter, Variety, the Los Angeles Times, or the New York Times saying, oh, it hasn't opened in Germany yet, or it hasn't opened in South Korea, that's basically the studio saying, well, we made $50 million this weekend, but remember, we haven't opened in Russia yet.
Right. So, you know, or they just know it's only opened in minimal territories or some. But they say it opened in 13 territories. Well, are they the 13 biggest? Are they, you know, 13 small? Do they anticipate most of their box office coming down the road? It's hard to tell, but Hunger Games, I'm pretty sure, has opened in most major territories. At number three around the world is Dr. Seuss's The Lorax. It grossed $22 million around the world. It's at $227 million and counting. At number four is the first remake of Snow White. This is called Mirror, Mirror with Julia Roberts. It grossed a smallish $19 million, and it basically opened in North America only. At number five around the world is 21 Jump Street, the reboot of the TV series. It grossed $19 million. It's at $115 million worldwide and counting. At number six, of course, the big flop of the spring, John Carter. It grossed $8 million around the world. It's at $254 million worldwide and counting. Its overseas totals have tripled the North American grosses, which are still around $60, $70 million. And that would be great news if they'd made more money in the U.S. If it had been just a modest hit in the U.S., $100, $150 million, then tripling that overseas would have meant they were at more like $500 million, and they could say, all right, we're not going to lose our shirt. But given how low it did in the U.S., tripling is not that big a claim anymore.
Yeah, they lost their shirt and their pants.
They didn't have it during the making of the movie, thank goodness. And number seven is The Pirates, Band of Misfits, the animated film. It grossed $8 million basically in the UK and a few other territories. At number eight is The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, the romantic drama that my mother can't wait to see. It stars every old actor you've ever heard of, like Judi Dench and Maggie Smith. It's grossed $6 million overseas, and it's at $44 million and counting.
And it's a film out of the UK, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Yeah. At number nine is This Means War, which grossed a modest $3 million. It's at $137 million and counting. And at number 10, as far as we can tell, the 10th highest grossing movie around the world is a French film called Mitzalor, or which I think means something like thin at the time or thin now. It's a French comedy about women trying to lose weight. It grossed $2.8 million, which goes to point out how top-heavy the box office has been the last two, 3 weeks since The Hunger Games. If you look in North America, the 10th highest grossing movie in the country grossed $800,000. I mean, this is very modest grosses. All the money's at the top. Hunger Games at $61 million, Wrath of the Titans, 34, Mirror Mirror, 19, 21 Jump Street, 15. There's a lot of money at the top of the chart, but very little once you get down below the top five.
Well, yeah, and just for all of those who will write in and say, you know, how could you say that Wrath of the Titans came in first place when obviously The Hunger Games came in first place? That is very true in North America. However, worldwide, which is what we focus on every week, we give you the worldwide grosses, not just the North American grosses. Sure, in North America, The Hunger Games earned $61 million to come in first place, but worldwide, Wrath of the Titans made $112 million to come in first place worldwide on a global basis.
That's right. And it opened huge. I mean, in North America, Hunger Games still grossed almost twice as much as Wrath of the Titans, even though it's in its second weekend. So Wrath of the Titans had a very poor opening in the U.S. It opened, I think the first movie was like 70 plus million.
Yes.
Something like that. So this is kind of like a classic sequel. In the old days, and you'd expect to make like half as much of the original on a sequel. Nowadays, with franchises like The Hunger Games and Harry Potter, you expect the same amount of money from every movie. You know, you're making seven movies or three movies or four movies. You expect to make this amount of money because they came out for the first two. And no matter how bad it is, people keep coming out. So, you know, or good.
Well, that's, but, I think, part of the problem is that, you know, you would see these horrible sequels to movies that were mediocre to begin with. And so now the audience is.
Well, that doesn't explain Twilight.
Well, that does not. Well, you know what explains Twilight is teenage girls.
Well, and a lot of things. But the other thing about The Hunger Games, what was it? I want to know about Wrath of the Titans. Do you know what the 3D business was?
I have no idea. I didn't even know the film was in 3D, although Clash of the Titans, of course, was the poster child for bad 3D conversion.
That's right. Well, I looked up. They apparently did a much better job with the 3D. This movie made 65% of its money from 3D and IMAX in North America.
Wow.
So
okay.
Is 65% high, low? What is that?
That's about where you want. You'd want it to be a little bit higher, maybe 70%. But 65% at this stage of the 3D game, that's not bad. When it's 45%, then you've really got to worry.
Then you're really saying that people just don't care.
Right.
But then this is just for opening weekend, obviously.
That's just opening weekend. That's right. And what will happen is it will start to get pushed off of 3D screens as other 3D titles hit the market.
Which is Titanic coming next week, I think.
Yes, and apparently it's quite good.
I'm seeing it tomorrow night, so I haven't seen it yet, but the trailer looked amazing. The other thing about Titans is I love the studio's explanation of its North American gross. They said, oh, it's not really an opening weekend. It's more like a preview because we've got Easter and spring break coming up. So we opened it up a week early, but it's really just a preview of what it's going to come.
Wait, they said that about Wrath of Titans?
Yeah, the studio was trying to explain why the movie opened low, and it said, well, we opened it up a week early, and it's going to have great legs because of Easter and spring break. So don't think of this as the opening weekend. Think of this as a preview.
Yeah, I don't buy that. Now, Mirror Mirror, I think they just had a really bad date. They, you know, really the film was geared towards 6 to 12 to 15-year-old girls, and they needed to appeal to...
I don't think their target audience was only girls 15 and younger.
Well, but
it's all women.
It's all women, and the part of the problem is most women were going to see The Hunger Games.
Well, but it is March. They opened it in March. It's not exactly like they pick a heavy date. You know, they thought they were picking a date that was, you know, not too heavy. They were going out one. They were going up against Wrath of the Titans. You know,
right. But in other words,
and a heavy violent film. I mean, they didn't know that they were going to come into the buzzsaw of The Hunger Games, and this is just bad luck.
Well, yeah, but you can kind of avoid that bad luck. I mean, you know, The Hunger Games is at least a, you know, worldwide sensation as a book, and people are talking about the movie months out. It's not
you
like,
would have rejiggered your date.
Yeah, I would have picked either, you know, maybe open it in the third or fourth week of Hunger Games where, you know, those girls, be they teenagers or in their 20s, they haven't been to the theater in a month. So they'll go back and see Mirror Mirror.
Do you think it would have made a lot more money? Or, I mean, or do you think maybe this is what it was meant to make? I mean, they like to come up with an excuse or an explanation of why a movie to make money. Sometimes it didn't get great reviews. It didn't, you know, I don't feel like there's a ton of money left on the table.
No, I don't think so either. Maybe 5 million, maybe 6 million, but no. I mean, it's not like it would have made $40 million if Hunger Games hadn't been out.
I mean, what we have coming up are, you know, American Pie movie, The Three Stooges. It doesn't look like there's a lot of female-friendly movies for a while. April 20th is probably the first one. That's the Zac Efron romantic film, The Lucky One. So that surely would be competition for female eyeballs. And then maybe April 27th with the 5-year engagement with Emily Blunt, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, now mind you, these are only North American release dates. These are not worldwide release dates necessarily.
Well, Mirror Mirror basically opened in North America.
Right.
So we're talking about the North American market as far as its competition.
Hey, you know what also opened in North America without a rating?
What's that?
Probably the most buzzed about movie and overcovered movie of the year, Bully, which is the Weinstein Company documentary on bullying in our schools.
Oh, you're effing kidding me. It opened up already?
Please, you know, mind your language. We don't want to become an NC-17 or R-rated podcast.
Right. I think it opened to a 23,000 per screen average, which is pretty great for a documentary, especially one like this. And I bet the Weinsteins are kicking themselves for not opening the movie wider with all the attention they had.
Well, they remember that they are still kind of building off of that attention, and they are opening it wider this week and the week after. So they're, you know, it's a traditional platform release where you open up in New York, LA, maybe Chicago, and then you expand from there. And
it's a documentary film, but I think in this case, with the strong reaction, I think maybe they would have done better to go bigger.
But that's right, and the strong reaction came from its rating, which was rated R, and the Weinsteins. And the director were saying, look, this is a film for teenagers. It's a film about bullying in high schools. We need every teenager to see this and to see how bad bullying is. By making it rated R, you're preventing them from seeing it.
More importantly, I think they were saying that as far as school showings and things like that for teachers, they couldn't show it in schools. I don't think it was so much that they need to get to see it in the theater, but there were school events scheduled that made it impossible because they couldn't show it because it was R.
Right. And I said at the time, hey, why not just recut it? And maybe bleep out those the F-bomb, I think, was the major problem that the MPAA had with it. So bleep out those few profane words, and you'll get a PG-13 rating. And you said, no, you know, that he shouldn't do that. Weinstein shouldn't do that because he got blasted for it on the King's Speech. And you're right, he did. But it looks like they're going to do it anyway.
Well, it's a very different case. The King's Speech is a piece of art, you know, as opposed to a documentary. I mean, it's a very different issue, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, and the context of both would make you think it should not have been an R-rated movie. The King's Speech should not have been R. No kid was going to go see the King's Speech so they could hear the F word.
No.
And I don't think any kid is going to go to Bully for the thrill of hearing the F word either.
No.
They can just go to their schoolyard.
No, I mean, it's certainly a film that has galvanized some opinions between, you know, with the rating system and, you know, we covered it. So it's gotten a lot of press, so much so that Microsoft is now participating with Weinstein and helping promote the film through their search engine Bing.
Well, that makes sense. I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know if it's any good, but, you know, more power to them.
Well, yeah, I mean, do you think that Microsoft, though, helping the Weinstein Company out on this film Bully, does that make them more hip, more Apple-esque, if you will?
No.
No? Okay.
I think it's just a reasonable public service thing to do.
Okay, well,
if you think helping a studio make a lot of money off a movie is public service.
Okay. All right. Well, then maybe move on to some other movie news. This past week, I think I've already asked you if you've read 50 Shades of Grey.
That's right. I have not.
Okay. Well, last weekend, there was all of this buzz about an ebook that was making its way through Hollywood. And I guess the author had visited town and she had, along with her agent, been talking to different producers and studios about turning the ebook into a feature film, and there was a huge bidding war. All the studios got involved. All these producers got involved. Everybody wanted it. It wound up selling, nobody's really sure, but for an estimated between $4 and $5 million for the rights to this book called 50 Shades of Grey. And of course, now the name of the author, E.L. James, it was escaping me for a moment there. She's written three books. But Michael, what is what makes this book unique besides the fact that it has yet to be published on paper?
That's not unusual anymore. A lot of books get published as ebook only, so I don't think that's unusual anymore. It's a big bestseller without a big publisher behind it. That's certainly unusual, but it began as fan fiction. You know, there are websites devoted to Star Wars and Star Trek and Twilight and The Lord of the Rings and any sort of franchise you can think of. And fans sort of write their fan fiction, new stories, new filling in the gaps, or what if, you know, characters who are old age in a retirement home. You know, they just come up with all sorts of new things, or gay twists on the storyline, that sort of thing. And fans fill up boards and fill up stuff with their fan fiction. Well, Twilight obviously is a very popular one. And this woman, E.L. James, is that it?
Yes.
Yeah. I want to say Gray, but of course that's the name of the book. She wrote fan fiction on the Twilight boards. It wasn't really terribly much about Twilight. If you look at the fan fiction from what it early as it originally began, as far as I can tell, they used the names of Edward and the other characters, but it had nothing to do with vampires, nothing to do with werewolves. It was just sort of this erotica using the names of these characters, and had very minimal to do with it. But it became really popular. People really liked it. She kept doing more and more, and then she finally ebooked the first bunch of stuff she wrote, called 50 Shades of Grey. And then that was like in 2011. And then that led to a sequel and then to a finale. And it's just erotica, or they're calling it mommy porn. Is there
now, why mommy porn? Because I look at this now, the main character is a 21-year-old college student who starts this relationship with
billionaire. Yeah, yes, a mysterious billionaire named Christian Grey.
In his late 20s, yes.
That's right, right. He's much older. He's in his late 20s.
Yes,
so they're both young and beautiful. He's super rich. She's a virgin, but she falls in love with him. He's had a damaged childhood, and he's a little confused. And he makes her his slave, in a sense. She has to sign a contract. It's very 9 1/2 weeks, if you've seen that movie. Very 9 1/2 weeks.
Oh, you're
but younger
yourself.
And
you're
sexier. No, yeah. I'm not. I can talk about Casablanca. It doesn't date myself. It's just a knowledge of film history.
Yes, 9 1/2 weeks, a film from the 80s, I believe.
It's starring Mickey Rourke. And
Kim Basinger.
Kim Basinger on the floor lapping up milk. Anyway, a very erotic film, according to some people. Silly, if you're like me. But there you go. It was erotica, massive worldwide hit. This is what Hollywood sees as the next 9 1/2 weeks, except they're younger and sexier and prettier. Not that she wasn't beautiful, but Mickey Rourke is nobody's idea of a sex symbol. In this case, we got young people. And he makes her sign a contract. She becomes his slave. He has his red room of pain, where she comes and finds herself suddenly more and more submitting to bondage and discipline and all this sort of crazy, kinky stuff. And, you know, it just goes on from there. So it's just naughty erotica. It has virtually nothing to do with Twilight, even though it began on the Twilight boards. It's not about vampires, not about werewolves. So nonetheless, some fans complain and say, it's not different enough from the Twilight. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's nothing like Twilight.
Well,
let
me ask you this. Do you think that if it wasn't for Twilight and the fact that she started on those boards with that kind of audience, that anybody would have seen this book at all?
I don't know what you mean. That's how it began, of course. I mean, she could have started online at the Star Trek board, whatever. She found an audience online, but she's not piggybacking on any creative work of Twilight. She just went somewhere where there's an audience, wrote her stuff. People really liked it, encouraged her to do more. It was all very natural. It wasn't like some plan or some scheme to, you know, become a best-selling author. Everybody would do that then. You know, you'd go to their boards, write great stuff. People go, oh, my God. You know, it wasn't a trick.
Yeah,
it's just,
I guess
she wrote it. People really liked it. And she kept going. It built and built and built until she finally decided to publish an ebook. It became a phenomenon. It's practically one of the few ebooks not backed by somebody big like, you know, a publisher or a media company like the New York Times, that became a huge bestseller. I mean, it happens. People self-publish. The Aragon Fantasy Books, that family published their son's book, Aragon, by themselves, self-published it, walked store to store to sell it, and that became a phenomenon. There's a story in the New York Times just yesterday, I believe, about parents publishing their children's books. Their kids write a book, you know, like maybe over the summer or whatever, and the parents literally publish it. So what? You know, it's posted online at Amazon. The kids get a physical copy. They got to pay for every copy they get, depending on which company you work with. It's just a fun little thing to do. How many of them turn out to be actual bestsellers? Virtually none. So it's not like she did a trick or something.
No, I guess what I'm saying is, if you're a busker, right? If you're a musician and you're out there busking, you don't want to be at the subway station that has nobody in it. You want to be in Times Square where, you know, there's lots of foot traffic.
There's millions of people posting music online. They don't all land major record label deals. I mean, there's tons of, you can be on MySpace. I could have a MySpace website today. that is used to have all the traffic in the world. I can post a video on YouTube. We just don't all become Justin Bieber. Again, the fact that it became recognized this way is not a trick. It's not a stunt. It's not anything. It's just another way of, you know, it's a different way of dealing with the slush pile. But it's not like fake untalented people or people who aren't going to be successful are going to rise to the surface because they were the first to post a video on YouTube. If I posted a video of me singing on YouTube, I would not have become Justin Bieber. You know, it's you're putting the cart before the horse. Don't confuse the medium with the message. No, don't confuse the way she gained attention with how she gained attention. She gained attention because people read her work, really liked it, kept reading it and asking for more.
Right. And then on March 9th, there was an article in the New York Times about this viral success of quote unquote mommy porn books. And this started the big feeding frenzy here in Hollywood. All the studio executives read this story, started looking up the book.
They weren't familiar with the book until March 9th?
Well, I find that hard to believe myself. If not, then
that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that doesn't make
sense. I think she just, you know, they were just timing the auction right. I think it's just a question of timing the auction. She had an agent. The book was signed to Vintage. It's coming out on the 3rd on Tuesday in paperback, the first book, and then the second and third will follow. I think it's just it's not that the Times article led them all to suddenly be aware of it, or they're idiots and they should lose their jobs, because this has been a sort of a notable phenomenon for a few months now.
Well, you know, apparently E.L. James, the author, got an unbelievable amount of concessions from Focus Features and Universal Pictures, the companies that purchased the book. She gets kind of the set approval and casting approval and director approval and final cut approval. I mean,
we don't know any of that confirmed.
That is correct.
That's just rumor. That's bull. She did not get final cut approval. That's ridiculous. She wouldn't want it. She wouldn't know what to do with it if she had it. That's just malarkey. That's just PR bull malarkey.
I was throwing final cut in, but apparently she gets, this is all not confirmed, script, director, and lead cast, but they did not insist on a quick progress to production, according to Michael Fleming over at Deadline Hollywood. And
who would?
Well, I guess a lot
who
of
would? That's like, well, that's conceding something you want. I want you to make it really quick and stupidly and cheaply. No, I want you to take your time and make the best film possible. It's like, that's again, this is all malarkey. Don't repeat what they say as if it means anything. To say that she didn't demand a quick, you know, filming of the movie. Well, why would she?
Well, there are some authors that have actually said, like the Da Vinci Code. The author said, fine, but you have to make the movie within the next 3 years.
No. 3 years is not a quick trigger pull. And that's just saying you have to make the movie or the rights revert to me. That's the standard thing. If you don't make the movie within a certain amount of time, or if you don't, people option books all the time. If they don't make the movie, then the rights revert to the author. That's a standard thing in every contract. I'm sure she has in her contract that if they don't make the movie in 3 years or something like that, that the rights revert to her. That always happens.
Well, I can tell you,
use a standard thing with standard practice with some crazy demand.
Well, having negotiated those contracts in the past, it depends on whether it is an option, in which case it's, hey, you have the option to buy the rights to this in the next 3 years. But if you don't do anything with it, you don't purchase the rights, then it reverts back to the author, or if you're purchasing the rights. Now, if you've purchased the rights...
Even if you purchase the rights, if you don't do anything with it, at some point, they're going to revert back to the author. You can't just purchase the rights and never make any movie, or people just buy everything really quick and then sit on them and be able to keep their competitors from making it.
And some people do. And that's exactly what you're absolutely right. Some people buy the rights in perpetuity, or they buy it for, you know, 50 years.
I don't know of any author who sold their book that you can own the rights for 50 years and never make a movie off of it. I've never heard of such a thing.
It does happen.
I don't believe it. No author with any power would sign off on that.
Well, I'm not saying that, you know, Hemingway was doing this. I'm saying that there are, I mean, I've negotiated them where it's an in perpetuity rights deal, but you knew the movie was being made. At that point, you had to do an in perpetuity because anyway, you knew the movie was going to be made.
This is all malarkey. It's Hollywood Reporter and Deadline Hollywood throwing in stuff. I bet she demanded the right to sign off on the set design. That's ridiculous. That makes no sense. What is she going to sign off on the sketches? Is she going to walk on the set and look at the set? I mean, you know, it's like those old stories where they say Oprah demands nobody looks her in the eye. You know, these are just silly, stupid rumors. There's no confirmation for them. Why repeat them?
Well,
they're stupid.
I have actually been on
set. She wants set approval.
I have actually been on a set of a music video of a very prominent artist.
No. You're talking about a feature film versus a music video. That's very different. Music videos have nothing to do with a $20 million feature film.
Well, either way, now some in Hollywood, and I don't know, maybe this is sour grapes, are saying, well, gee, you know, how are they going to turn this book, which has some really graphic sex scenes in it, into a movie that's even R-rated, let alone, you know, NC-17? How are they going to do that? It could turn out to be like a Saturday Night Live skit if they don't handle it properly.
Well, it's certainly tricky. Erotica is always tricky, and it's not going to be easy to do. And their big audience, obviously, is adult women, but they obviously want teenage women, but they're not going to get them with an R rating. So, you know.
That's true.
They're certainly not going to get 16-year-old girls to go to a bondage film.
Well, if you can't get 16-year-old girls to go to a bondage film, can we get Michael Giltz to sign up for Spotify?
I haven't done it yet.
I know. I've noticed that you not Mog, not Ardio, not Stitton. You don't have any of these.
I have too much music. I don't have time.
Well, I've signed up for Spotify, but apparently I didn't need to because they have extended their free listening program in the U.S. I guess when they launched 9 months ago, they said, look, we'll give for a limited time, we'll allow all, like, unlimited free listening, although there will be commercials, to all the free accounts. You know, you can listen as much as you want. And right around now, they were supposed to lower that free listening to 10 hours of listening per month. And they've never, they're saying, no, we're not going to do that.
And it's indefinite. They haven't said we're going to do it for another 3 months or 6 months. They're saying indefinitely, you'll be able to just keep listening to Spotify for free.
That's right. And, you know, look, there are other services out there, as I've mentioned, Ardio, Mog, Rhapsody, Deezer, and I think
Pandora.
I'm just naming things off the top of my head. You're absolutely right. Pandora. I think that in part this is because of the competition, and they're also looking to raise a little bit more money. They've already raised $100 billion. They want to raise another round of financing with a $3.5 billion valuation. So they need as much press and publicity as they can get to keep their name out there in front of all of these other competitors.
Isn't it just as lucky that they're not signing up people fast enough? You know, they're saying we've got an audience, they're here, but they're not signing up. And if we shut the door, we're going to suddenly find ourselves with a tiny audience.
Right. But I guess what? They now have 2.5 million paid subscribers. And, you know, when they were just in Europe, they had, you know, 1 million paid subscribers. So they moved over the pond and they got another million. So it's not like they're doing too bad.
Yeah, but they're spending tons of money for the licensing rights to music. They're losing money every month, aren't they?
Oh, well, they must be because, you know, especially with unlimited free streaming. Sure, the ads pay for some of it, but
and
not
now
all of
they're
it.
Promised they'll continue losing money indefinitely.
That's right. That's right. Please give us
money. Doesn't
sound
to me like a strong winning. They're making it sound as strong as possible, but to me, it's a sign of weakness.
Well, I think, you know, most companies will tell you when they're in startup mode, yes, you lose money initially to gain market share, to gain traction, but eventually that flips around and you start earning. I don't know how you do that with a company like this.
You sign up people to subscribe.
Well, yeah, I guess that's a good point. You're absolutely right. But can you do that? Well, I guess if you're paying $120 a year, does the $120 a year per user actually break even?
Sure. That's real money, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, well,
depends on how much they listen, whatever, blah, 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 per hours. But yeah.
Well, a couple months ago, actually, Spotify announced that they were going to allow certain developers to create applications for their service. And Rolling Stone did it, Billboard did it, and a group called Songkick did it. Have you ever been to Songkick?
No, I have not.
Well, it's a website, and I've been to it a couple times, and I've signed up and picked a few artists, and every once in a while I'll get an email saying, hey, Ryan Adams is going to be in your neighborhood playing a show, which is kind of nice to hear.
Well, the nice thing is they don't announce it when the show happens. They announce it when tickets are going to go on sale.
That's right. They announce it
far. That, to me, is the key thing. When I was applying for a job at Time Out New York, when they were launching that, my big thing, one of the things I suggested in my, you know, interview, my proposal was, hey, you guys should publish not a list of concerts in town, but when tickets are going on sale, because that's when it matters. By the time the concert comes to town, when Bruce is here and whenever, the show will be sold out. You need to know when tickets go on sale. So for me, that was always my big focus as a music fan. So I think it's a really clever service.
Yeah,
they say if you're following an artist, they'll let you know when that artist announces tickets for a concert in your area.
Right, and you can follow them directly through Songkick, or Songkick created this app, and they've added 100,000 new users with their Spotify app in just 4 months. And you think, well, that's not very many. But, you know, it is for a startup like Songkick that's doing this and has to get the word out. That's not bad. They say that millions of personalized concert alerts for 50,000 concerts have been sent to users who registered through Spotify. And that's good for Spotify. That's good for Songkick. That's good for the bands. It's good for everybody.
And where do they make their money, I wonder? Do the artists pay to be part of Songkick to have alerts sent out, or is it just done for free? Or I wonder how that all works.
Yeah, I don't know how they make their money. That's a darn good question. Maybe it's through referral fees, so that if Songkick tells me that Bon Iver is coming to town and I click on the link and get sent to Ticketmaster, that Ticketmaster is giving an affiliate fee to Songkick. I don't know. That's a very good question, between advertising and affiliate fees, how they're making their money. But what's interesting to me is that Spotify is actually becoming more of an ecosystem or a platform to turn to, much like Facebook.
That's right, exactly. Is Songbook on Songkick on Facebook?
Actually, I don't know about Songkick, but I know Spotify is. And there were a number of stories last week about how Spotify turned their Facebook page into a timeline that detailed the history of music, stretching all the way back to the year 1099.
What happened in 1099, I wonder?
I have no idea. Maybe Facebook's timeline ran out. I have no idea. Maybe the intern that they got to put all of the history on this timeline went to lunch. I have no clue.
Yeah.
But, speaking of which, we have to figure out for ourselves here at Showbiz Sandbox what we're going to do with our Facebook page, because according to Facebook, they have switched all of their pages over to timeline now.
All right. I don't know what that means.
So you don't visit Facebook that often.
I mean, I know I've seen that, but I don't know what it means in a practical sense.
Well,
is there something new we have to do? Or, I mean, I have a Facebook page. I haven't done anything.
Well, I mean, it's a different way of looking at your Facebook page. Instead of it being just a wall with posts on it, you can actually scroll back in time and see, oh, Michael read this book on such and such a date, and he went to see such and such a movie on, April 1st, 2011.
Exciting.
Yeah, well.
Can't you do that already? If you click on someone's profile, you just scroll down.
Yeah, but then you'd have to
scroll. But it's different.
Yeah, it's different. It's different. I'm getting the sense that you don't find this whole Facebook timeline thing to be a big deal at all.
I don't think so, because it feels like you have to do a lot of work to feed the beast. You know, it works if you put a lot of effort into it.
And that's exactly what Facebook wants. They want you to show up, put a lot of work into it, because once you put a lot of work into it, you're going to come back because you've got a lot invested in it.
Yeah, I think it's a big whoop.
Okay, well, maybe some of these other stories you'll think are a big deal, because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, talking about books that have a huge following. J.K. Rowling is finally making the Harry Potter books available online in digital form. Her elaborate website and store, which is called Pottermore, has put ebook editions up for sale. The rest of the site is still in beta mode, but expects to open sometime in April. So now how does all of this work? The first three books are $8 each in ebook form, and the last four are $10 each. You can also buy audiobook versions with a choice of the U.S. Jim Dale performing the roles or the U.K. Stephen Fry performances. And other languages will follow in both ebook and audiobook options. Now, the books, and this is what's interesting to me, they have no DRM, but they are individually watermarked to discourage theft. The ebooks are compatible with every single device out there. And rather remarkably, something else that's amazing is, if you go to Amazon and Barnes & Noble, they actually provide a link so you can buy the ebooks on the Pottermore website, but you're actually starting your purchase on, say, Amazon. Surely this has never happened before and will probably never, if ever, happen again.
Never if ever.
I like my double negatives and to be redundant. Apple, of course, said, heck no. They refuse to link people to an outside site. Is this Pottermania a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal in this one isolated case. It doesn't really have big long-term implications unless you're one of the best-selling authors in history. But it is pretty amazing to see Apple and Amazon and Barnes & Noble link you and send you to an outside site to buy a book. It's just, it's kind of trippy. It's kind of amazing. That's the power of Harry Potter. They want people to be happy and use their Kindles and get the book. They can't sell it on their own, and they were willing in this one case to send people to J.K. Rowling's website. Kind of amazing.
It's kind of interesting, the whole no DRM, so you don't have to worry about, oh, geez, I bought the Kindle version, but now I have a Barnes & Noble Nook, and I can't transfer it. You can, and rather than put all this DRM so that it can't be transferred, they just say, look, we'll just stack your name right there. We'll just put your name on every page. So you pirate it, everybody in the world will know.
Well, is that what they do, literally?
Yeah, they watermark each page.
I know they watermark, but they put your name?
That's right, yes.
I mean, watermark doesn't necessarily mean your name.
That's true. It could be a number, but basically it's some identifying mark tied back to you.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the way a lot of people should go.
Yes, I
hate digital rights management, but we know that.
Yes. Well, now we've talked a lot about, you know, how are television shows doing in the overseas markets, in the international markets. And I thought this story was kind of interesting. Warner Brothers, the studio behind the hit NBC drama ER, is shopping the format now around to networks all over the world. They plan on selling ER to the UK and in Germany. That'll be like ER Germany and so on. And as a template, really, for a franchise, a localized version of the franchise. And this is a quote: ER is one of the most successful, long-running, highly rated, and recognizable television programs ever created and remains in syndication around the world. So we are confident that a wide variety of territories will want to produce their own local version of the show. And that was said by a Warner Brothers spokesperson. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's sort of a big deal, but what took them so long? I mean, we've seen local franchises of The Office, for example, that began in the UK, and that has had versions in Japan and all over the world, including obviously North America. ER has been off the air for 2 years. I guess I'm a little surprised it didn't happen years ago. That's sort of the one thing that confuses me. But this is kind of an interesting new thing. ER obviously played all over the world as its original show, and now they want an India version and a German version and a French version. That's the idea. We've seen it with game shows. Game shows start like in different countries and get duplicated all over the world. It's kind of interesting to see it happen with dramas. Sitcoms seem slightly less odd. I mean, we've been copying UK shows and shows from other countries throughout our history, like All in the Family. That was based on a British soap, British sitcom called Till Death Us Do Part. But ER, it's kind of a weird thing. Like, what exactly is the gimmick or the franchise or the template that they're stealing there? It's just set in an emergency room.
I was going to say, you know, why couldn't they just say, you know, I'm sorry, we just decided to set our, you know, 1 hour medical drama in a hospital, in a teaching
yeah,
hospital.
Yeah. I mean, Law and Order's doing this. There's a Law and Order UK, and they have Law and Order local franchises all over the world. I assume that they rip from the headlines from their local country just as much as they do from the US. It's interesting. I mean, the idea of like TV shows used to take them and sell them all over the world, make hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in the case of ER. It's probably a $1 billion franchise. I mean, it ran for 15 years. So that's a huge property. Now they're going to take it and duplicate it all over the world. We've sort of seen this before, and now it seems to be becoming more and more common every day. It's kind of interesting.
Well, the headline here says Warner Brothers will begin to sell ER format rights overseas. It doesn't say they have sold them overseas.
No, I know.
So what I mean is, so they may not be able to find a buyer.
I mean, ER is a very, 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 it's a huge name. If you could have your local sitcom called Seinfeld, that's better than saying local sitcom called Three Guys in a Diner. You know, it's easier sell. So I'm pretty sure that they will have, you know, good luck selling it. I'm surprised it took so long, and it's an interesting development.
Now, we've talked about this next story before. In fact, we've talked about this case before. Blogger Jonathan Tessini led a class action lawsuit against your stomping grounds, Michael, the Huffington Post, claiming that the website was unduly enriched by the work of bloggers who contributed to the site's success. Now, this arose after the Huffington Post was sold to AOL for $315 million. But a judge in Chicago dismissed the case, and he said, and quoting here, "There is no question that the plaintiffs submitted their materials to the Huffington Post with no expectation of monetary compensation, and that they got what they paid for. Exposure in the Huffington Post." No word on whether Tessini can or even will appeal. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael? Or do you have to refrain from answering?
Well, I'm not an employee of Huffington Post, obviously, so I certainly don't have to refrain. It's a big whoop. We thought the case was stupid to begin with. We're not lawyers, but a lot of times the law follows common sense. And in this case, you say, look, nobody demanded that you post there. They wouldn't even talk to you. So the idea that, you know, you of your own free will kept submitting articles to Huffington Post when they wouldn't even talk to you or encourage you or say, oh, we want more of this or less of that. You know, they don't even talk to you. You were given the opportunity. You decided to do it. You had no idea whatsoever that they were going to suddenly start throwing money at you. The idea you could turn around and sue and say, I deserve a piece of the company, was just so stupid. It just made no common sense. And the law has followed that path. However, I will say at the time, I think there was a survey sent out by Huffington Post to all the bloggers saying, what do you think about the site? What do you like about this? What do you like about that? Do you think you should get paid? Do you think you should get a piece of the sale? Do you think you should get paid a monthly flat fee? Do you think you should get paid by article? What's your feelings? What's your idea? What's your take back? And we'll let you know what everybody thinks. Well, they asked, they did that survey. They sent it out. I filled it out. I sent it back. Never heard a word from them again. Maybe they were waiting for the end of this lawsuit. So that might be the reason, or maybe they just didn't like what they heard from all their bloggers.
Right. Well, and especially because they were sending it out right around the time of the sale to AOL. But what's interesting,
well, it was after. Yeah. And it was in response to blogger upset.
That's right. Now, what's interesting here is on a legal, looking at this legally only, basically, this judge is saying your compensation was exposure. So you're paying for something and you're getting the product.
They had no expectation of compensation. And his phrase, they got what they paid for, is just casually. They were not compensated. They weren't asked for compensation. They didn't expect compensation. They had no reason to expect compensation. They did it for free because they wanted to, because they could. It's like, you know, if the New York Times opened their website and said you can post articles on NewYorkTimes.com, a lot of people would do it. And the New York Times might find it to their benefit, but they were not compensated. They said they knew that if they posted on Huffington Post, a lot of people would see it potentially, and they did it because they wanted to.
Yeah, I know that there is some, and I'm not familiar enough with the law where you gain financially from somebody else's work that you don't pay for. But effectively, what the judge is saying is, no, the Huffington Post did pay for it. They got the exposure.
No. He's not saying that you received compensation in the form of publicity. He's saying you never expected compensation. You knew you weren't going to get any money or anything in return. You did it because you wanted to, because you knew it would be a little more visible than if you did it on your own website. But that's not compensation. He's not saying you were fairly compensated via exposure. He's saying you never expected compensation in the first place. You knew not to expect it.
He said monetary compensation. And that is a very important, when you're dealing with the law, that is a very important distinction between monetary compensation and any other type of compensation.
Why are we arguing about legal definitions of terms when neither one of us is a lawyer?
Because I've seen Law and Order.
Yeah, the judge said you didn't expect to get any paid anything. You weren't paid anything. End of story. It was ridiculous for them to expect that it would suddenly get a cut of the sale because they decided for free of their own free will to post online. End of story.
Moving on. Nickelodeon has been struggling in the ratings for a while, and top
management... It's like we struggled through that last story.
Right, exactly. Well, now top management has said that rating dips were blips and they were easily explained. Well, try to explain this then, Nickelodeon. The Disney Channel has passed Nickelodeon in the average number of total daily viewers. Fans complained about Nickelodeon's heavy use of SpongeBob reruns and cheered Disney's live-action shows like Jesse and Good Luck Charlie. Is this changing of the guard in kids' cable kind of a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a very big deal because changes in viewing patterns takes a long, long time. Like you can look at Today's Show and Good Morning America. Today's Show has been number one for decades. It's not changing anytime soon. It's very hard to get people to change their patterns. And they have slowly changed their patterns for kids in daytime television. They have slowly migrated from Nickelodeon to the Disney Channel. Or I should say, in fact, kids have walked away from the television in droves. Actually, all viewing is down in these day parts. For Nickelodeon and Disney have both lost viewers, but Disney only lost 5% of their viewers compared to a year ago. Nickelodeon is down 31%. Almost a third of their viewers have stopped watching Nickelodeon in the past year. That's a huge drop. So Disney has simply lost fewer viewers than Nickelodeon, substantially fewer. And that's why they've closed the gap and are now ahead of Nickelodeon in the daytime television viewing of little kids. But it's a very big deal.
So you're saying it's kind of a measurement of inchworms here. It's like,
well, they're both good businesses and they both make a lot of money. The Cartoon Network is up 16%. So presumably some of the kids who walked away from these shows went over to the Cartoon Network. Maybe they got a little older. Cartoon Network, I think, skews a little bit older, perhaps, in both the type of programming it does and the audience that it draws. But, you know, losing a third of your audience is never a good story. Even if Nickelodeon were still ahead, they'd have a bad story to tell.
Now, this next story I really picked for you because I thought, you know, this is kind of interesting. You know, we've talked about how all of these movies are headed to Broadway, whether it's Sister Act last week we were talking about, or
Diner, Flashdance, Bullets Over Broadway,
you name it,
Bring It On, Father of the Bride, The Nutty Professor, A Room with a View. These are all musicals in the works to come to Broadway.
Well,
Flashdance.
You already mentioned that. Yeah. Well, now director Kevin Smith wants to take Clerks, his first film, his indie hit about a guy working in a convenience store. He wants to take that to Broadway. It makes sense, though, to Smith. They rehearsed it like a play. People felt the one set location made the movie feel a little bit like a play, and they've already done feature films and an animated series based on the film. So what's left except for Broadway, really? The show would hit Broadway in 2014 for its 20th anniversary. if and only if, this is a big if, Smith can convince actor Jeff Anderson to reprise his role as Randall Graves. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop in general. It's another show coming to Broadway. Thank God it's not a musical, though. When I read it, I thought, is it Clerks the musical? But no, it's meant to be a comedy, a drama on Broadway. Once you think about it, I guess it's not so crazy, though. The idea of casting all the original actors from the movie in the play is very concerning. I mean, it's a very different skill to be in an indie film versus on a Broadway stage. So the idea that Jeff Anderson and Kevin Smith and the other guys can pull it off, I don't know why you would cast them. I think, you know, you should be getting new actors. If you have any hope of it working, I think you would want actual seasoned professionals.
Well, there was a Clerks 2 movie, and this is supposed to be like the third part of a trilogy.
Well, I didn't say it wasn't. I'm just saying guys who have barely acted in movies are not necessarily going to be able to work on stage. Even seasoned movie actors can't necessarily do good work on stage. So plocking them down on Broadway is not necessarily a great idea. Even the best film actors are not really suited always for theater. So
point taken.
That's what I'm worried about.
Now this next story, it's a head shaker here in Los Angeles.
Why?
Well, I'll explain. Basketball legend Magic Johnson has won again. This time it's the team he led bidding for the baseball franchise, the Los Angeles Dodgers. They scored the winning bid, which was valued at a tad over $2 billion. But, you know, really, what's $100 million here and there among friends? It's the highest amount ever paid for a North American sports franchise, nearly doubling the $1.2 billion paid for the NFL's Miami Dolphins just 3 years ago. Why are the Dodgers worth so much money? TV. Those cable channels devoted to a team are very valuable indeed. The Yankees cable channel, in fact. The Yes Network is valued at $1 billion all on its own. So is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, I'm just intrigued. I want to know why you're so upset about it.
Well, because I think at this point in baseball's history, it is time for Bud Selig to go. This is a guy...
What does this have to do with Bud Selig?
This is a guy who allowed Fox to purchase the Dodgers in the first place. Okay, that was a legitimate sale. Fox purchased the Dodgers from the O'Malley family. But then he allowed Frank McCourt to come in. And at the time, in 2004, when Frank McCourt bought the team, I said publicly, wait a second, this is a guy that has to finance the purchase of the team. He's borrowing the money from the person selling him the team. So how can he actually run the team?
Well, why can't you buy the team?
Yeah, I mean, we all know how that worked out. I mean, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars were kind of embezzled from the Dodgers and went into his pocket. And rather than find an appropriate buyer, they went with this conglomerate of private equity. It's a private equity firm, and everybody knows what private equity does. Just ask Mitt Romney. Private equity buys...
Strip it down.
Right. They buy a company.
Pile up debt.
Yeah. They turn it around or they pile up debt, and then they sell it off at a profit. So why would you allow that to happen again? And I get that Magic Johnson is a part of it, and I get that he's the face of, you know, so many things here in Los Angeles. But you know what? He's a minor player in this, and the private equity firm has put him out front as if he's the majority owner. He's not. He owns a fraction of a fraction of the Dodgers now, but he's the public face. And there were so many other buyers that were more appropriate, but Frank McCourt had the rights to pick the buyer, and he picked a $2 billion buyer. It's remarkable to me. The guy bought the franchise just 7 years ago for $400 million, and he's selling it now for $2 billion.
How much does he get to walk away with, do we know?
Well, think about it. Even if he says,
okay. I mean, he has all that debt and stuff.
Right. So even if you say, okay, the $400 million, I have to pay that back. And let's say I ran up 100% of that in debt as well.
Or $1 billion in debt.
Yeah.
So say $1 billion.
Yeah. Let's say I'm walking away with $1 billion. Plus, I get to keep the parking lot, so I get money from the parking lot.
So you feel like Bud Selig did a terrible job in putting baseball front and center. He just went for the biggest deal from the biggest names he could, rather than saying who wants to be a long-term buyer of this franchise, who is going to be invested in baseball and build this team for decades to come.
That's right. I mean, he basically allowed Frank McCourt to pick the highest bidder rather than the most appropriate bidder. And I'm not saying that Frank McCourt should have been, you know, given a dollar for the team. I'm saying that, you know, there were some other players that were there. Not that I had a fish in this fight or, you know, a dog in this fight. I didn't. But
a fish? You know, a fish?
I couldn't think of the animal.
You didn't have a mackerel in this fight.
And
I didn't have a
title.
Fish in this fight. Well, you know, they said it's the highest ever paid for a North American franchise. I've tried to find a bigger one overseas. I know Man United sold for like $1.5 billion or just under that, like a few years ago, like 2005. But I can't find it. I assume it's some soccer team or something, football team, obviously, to them. But I can't find of anything higher. But I assume from the wording that it must have happened.
Well, you know, the television rights, they're not going to start their own network, per se, the way the Yankees did with the YES Network. But Fox has already offered them $3 billion for the television rights over the next 10 years.
Well, so, there you go.
So you're
good
buying
money.
Something for $2 billion that you already know is worth $3 billion.
Well, and over 10 years, $300 million a year, you can mount a pretty good team for that amount of money.
That's right. So is it a big deal?
I think it's a big deal in the way you put it, absolutely.
Well, ABC is airing the Emmy Awards on September 23rd of this year, and their choice to host is late night survivor Jimmy Kimmel. Kimmel has done other award shows like the ESPYs and the American Music Awards, but this will really be his first time doing one of the biggies, so to speak. What? Neil Patrick Harris wasn't available? ABC surely hopes to do better than the last time it aired the Emmys and went with the motley team of Ryan Seacrest, Jeff Probst, Heidi Klum, Tom Bergeron, and Howie Mandel. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop, as our old friend Karen Woodward, would say, man gets job.
Okay, well, this is about, this next story is kind of about people keeping their job, but maybe getting a little bit of extra scratch for keeping their job. The cast of the hit ABC sitcom Modern Family is looking for a little bit of a raise. They got a bump, of course, when the show was really an out-of-the-box hit, and now they're talking amongst themselves about getting a bigger raise come the fourth season, which is kind of natural. That's really the year when stars often renegotiate and agree to extend their contract to appear in 8 or 9 seasons instead of 7, and they get a big bump in salary. And on rare occasions, a piece of the back end for doing so. The cast of Friends famously negotiated as a group. The adults on Modern Family make about $65,000 an episode, which is low for a show with that kind of ratings. And they want $200,000 per episode. Again, that's kind of average. Ed O'Neill was the big name in that cast, and he already makes $100,000 per episode. They might still negotiate as a group and then ask for a percentage increase so that Ed O'Neill would then maintain his edge over them. Because, you know, God knows, after 11 seasons of Married with Children, the man needs some money. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's what happens. The show's a big hit. They want more money. It's perfectly natural. I like that this trend of negotiating together continues. There's a couple interesting things here. One is, you say it's natural or it's normal. That's normal for a really big hit show. This is one of the 2 or 3 biggest hit sitcoms on the air, and it's anchoring ABC's sitcom lineup. So
Oh, absolutely. It's
normal when you're on the top of the heap. It's not normal for a mid-range or low-level show. You're on a major network. You're a big hit. You're the anchor of the entire network. You're their defining sitcom. You win Emmys. I mean, they're the king of the hill.
You're absolutely right. I mean, if you're struggling for a fifth season, then no, you're not asking for a raise. But if you know you're going to get a fifth and
sixth, you're the hottest show on television.
So, yeah. So you're going to, I mean, when they sign these contracts, you don't sign for just 1 year. You're signing for 4 years because that's what allows a show to go into syndication.
But more like usually 5, I heard, but it sounds like they're locked in until 7 years. That was another thing that intrigued me, that they said instead of the 7, they're going to extend to 8 or 9. So I guess when they got their first bump,
that's right. They
said, all right, we'll go from 5 seasons to 7 seasons. And now they want their second bump. So they're saying, all right, now we'll go to 8 or 9 seasons. Do we want 9 seasons of Modern Family? I don't. Even if you love the show, it should not be on that long. But
I mean,
that's another
story. Their youngest kid will be through law school at that point and could come on the show and tell us that what the deal is with this blogger suit.
I tried to fact check the Hollywood Reporter again because they had an article about this, and they said that the show has become TV's number one scripted series among younger viewers and is the highest rated comedy since Friends and Will and Grace. And I'm like, highest rated comedy since Friends and Will and Grace? It's not even the highest rated comedy on the air right now because The Big Bang Theory and 2.5 Men are bigger. They have higher averages for the season. But apparently they were arguing that they were only talking about their demos, meaning they're the highest rated comedy in the 18 to 49 demos since Friends and Will and Grace. But that's not even true. Except then they said, no, we're only talking about the demos once you add in DVR plus 7, which means the total amount of DVR viewers who watch it within a week before the next episode.
Yeah, live plus 7 is what they call that.
Which raises an interesting question, because they don't get to set their ad rates to DVR plus 7,
no,
right?
No, they don't. Well, I don't think so.
I mean, people take it into account a little bit. But I wish that there was a good rating system that would show me, like, we get weekly ratings in USA Today and elsewhere published all the time, and overnight ratings. I really would like easy long-term access to saying, hey, here's the show season to date based on all the ratings, you know, DVR plus 7. Here's their demo ratings. Here's everything. You can find it piecemeal, but I wish when people did those weekly rankings that they would include all this information, you know, and frankly, even more information like, you know, watches on YouTube or Hulu or whatever, you know, on the network website.
I think they're going to start including that. They have to. I mean,
yeah, it just, we're not getting the full picture because I had to, I broke down the Modern Family numbers again and again and saw them in second or third place. But then DVR plus 7 in the 18 to 49 demos, yes, they seem to have a significant lead. Okay, interesting, right. Important, but I shouldn't have to spend 3 days figuring that out.
Well, you know, here we're talking about a show, Modern Family, that's very successful and very well may go on to 8 or 9 seasons. Then there are shows like Terra Nova, and they don't go on to even a second season. The dinosaurs are extinct. Fox's family drama Terra Nova was hoping to stay alive via a deal with Netflix, and we discussed this in the past, but the numbers just didn't add up, and Netflix is taking a pass. Unless another suitor steps up, it's almost certain the freshman drama will be gone for good. Still, Fox hasn't given up hope. They've kept the actors under contract, ensuring that none of them are available for the fall pilot season, currently being cast. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
A big whoop. It was not a big ratings hit, not a big creative hit. So, you know, I mean, it was okay. You watched it. You sort of liked it. It was okay. But, you know, okay. So Fox canceled it. Nobody else picked it up. It rarely happens.
You know, I still have 6 episodes of Terra Nova to watch on my own DVR. So that would be live plus 8 months, I think. Matthew Weiner is the creator of Mad Men. Well, he is finally seeing another dream project of his come to fruition. He wrote the screenplay You Are Here before he even worked on Mad Men and that ever struck. And the work got some buzz, but he couldn't ever nail down casting for the film. Now, finally, after fits and starts, the movie has come together and will shoot in the spring in between seasons of Mad Men. It stars Owen Wilson as a weatherman, and Zach Galifianakis will be playing his bipolar best buddy. They go on a road trip when Wilson's dad dies and deal with a huge inheritance. Wilson's greedy sister, Amy Poehler, and Wilson's awkward desire to sleep with his dad's young widowed wife. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. I mean, if Matthew Weiner can't land a movie deal, God help us all.
That's true.
Though, you know, if they were headed to a red room of pain, I bet the movie would be really popular and successful. But that's just my idea.
That's maybe with the young widowed wife.
Yeah.
Hey, somebody get me a pen. Get me a studio executive on the
line. I bet there's Mad Room fan fiction. I bet they could do a better job than the scripts that we've been seeing.
Well, that's true. Let's move on to, you know, some more rumors that I know you love. Details, or really, as I just mentioned, rumors, are slipping out about the new PlayStation game console, which is dubbed the Orbis. I don't get that. But the big news? They won't bother to offer backwards compatibility even for a few months or year. So all those games that you've bought for the PS3, yeah, you can replace them. And if you want to buy new games cheaply by waiting for a used copy to pop up at, say, EB Games or GameStop, you can forget about that as well. The new machine will have software that insists that every game be linked specifically to one machine. You can't even take the game to a friend's house and play it together, and you certainly can't buy a used copy. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal, and I think it should be a lawsuit. I mean, I have there are lots of issues about this argument that you're licensing books and not actually buying them when you get them on an ebook. This argument that you cannot rent or, you know, you can't sell your copy of a video game or even take it to a friend's house to watch it. Those are fair uses of video games, and I don't think they have the right to tell you you can't do it. I don't think, even though they have the ability, and you may buy the software and the company, the console in hand, knowing you can't do it, I still think it's illegal on their part. It's like saying you can buy a hardcover book, but you can't give it to your wife and let her read it. Really? Can you tell me that? They have the technology to do that, but do they have the right? And I really think it needs to be a lawsuit, because I think this is malarkey that you cannot buy used copies of video games or take it to a friend's house to play and all this other stuff. They have the physical ability to do it, but I think it's illegal, and I think they need to be challenged.
Well, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I think, first of all, just from a technology standpoint, doing away with backwards compatibility, especially for a consumer product,
that's annoying. So annoying.
It is annoying, and I understand why sometimes it just has to be done. Now, Apple does it so they can sell more hardware. That's annoying. And the Xbox 360 didn't play most of the games for the original Xbox. It did take a while for them to catch up and allow all those games to be played on the Xbox 360, but at least they eventually did. You know, these people, you buy these games, and yes, they're not the greatest games to be played. You know, if they're 4 or 5 years old, the technology has moved on. I get it. But to force the issue by not having, by throttling what people can do with the device you're selling them, and I guess really, you know, another point here, are you buying a copy of a video game or are you licensing it as software? Because if you're buying it, then you're right, Michael. They are not, well, they're breaking the law. The first sale doctrine applies. That's one of the reasons that you can sell a book to the Strand bookstore. It's one of the reasons you can buy a used DVD. It's one of the reasons you can buy a used video game.
Yeah, they want to claim your license in it, but I think they're wrong. They can claim it all they want. It needs to be challenged in court. And are you even using it to play games anyway? That's what I'd like to know. Because it seems like these players, I have a PS3 in my home. I've played games on it like twice because I'm afraid to. I don't want to get addicted. I use it as a Blu-ray player and to connect online to, Netflix and other stuff like that. I use it as really that device that everybody wants to create in the home to be your sort of central command to link you to your TV to the outside world.
So kind of like a Google TV or a Roku box.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I use my PS3. Yeah. I watch Blu-ray on it and I connect to the outer world.
Well, Xbox, you know, Microsoft's Xbox 360 video game console, the company now says that households spend an average of 84 hours a month on the Xbox Live service, playing games, watching videos, and listening to music, which is up 30% from a year ago, but just over half that time is spent on videos and music and television, not playing video games. So
most of the time they use the Xbox 360 to do what I do.
Right, precisely. And what they're kind of citing is, hey, look, you know, these people are playing video games and then they're sticking around on the Xbox to do all this other stuff. And they just stick around longer to do the other stuff.
Yeah. Every time I turn on my PS3, I get the Netflix and other stuff, you know, that's all, and their own video on demand that always pops up first. And I have to click over to get to the video in the DVD section.
Okay.
Which is why they're offering things like on Xbox, they have like HBO Go, they have Major League Baseball. They're adding all this other stuff.
You still have to have a subscription to all those services, but now you can get it through the Xbox.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know,
sue the companies, sue them, over their video game restrictions.
Well, you know, we were just talking about, you know, whether you'll be able to rent a video game or buy a used video game. And it looks like DVD renting is down from 2010. According to industry player RentTrack, people in the U.S. spent $5.6 billion renting DVDs and Blu-rays in 2011 at bricks and mortar stores, which is down 3.4% from the figure in 2010. In the last 3 months, however, the last 3 months of 2011, this trend accelerated with rentals and brick and mortar stores down 21%, while businesses at kiosks like Redbox were up 28%. So big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop because I have no idea what's going on. This is a very poor story. It was on Deadline, I'm afraid, deadline.com. But when you first glanced at it, I thought it was talking about all rentals. It says U.S. rentals are down 3.4%. I'm like, okay. But then when you find out they're only talking about like Blockbuster and brick and mortar stores. Well, what about the kiosks? They didn't count those. What about streaming? What about online? You know,
well, I thought they did count those because they said business at kiosks like Redbox was up
20%. No. These figures are not about that. They're saying that it's strictly, they're talking about rentals at brick and mortar stores. How many physical copies of DVDs and Blu-rays were rented from bricks and mortar stores? And a kiosk is not a brick and mortar store, apparently. It's a very short article, very poorly done. Again, you got to look at the bigger picture. You know, we don't care. I mean, it's important to the people in the industry, whether people are going to Blockbuster or to a Redbox or they're streaming it or they're downloading it. That matters to them. But to us, when we want to know how's the rental business, we want to look at the whole pie. Because anything else is just sort of detail.
Right. And it's, it's that sensationalist, you know, DVD renting down.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, they say DVD sales down, and they don't mention that they're not including Blu-ray sales. And you're like, really? Because DVDs aren't Blu-rays. It's like, come on. You got to tell us what, you know, are you really upset DVD is down 10% if Blu-ray is up 40%? I don't think so.
Well, I think Best Buy would be able to tell you that DVD sales are down. In fact, Best Buy is getting pounded by, quote unquote, showcasing the phenomenon where people go to the big box stores, just like, you know, Best Buy or what would be another one? Costco. And they compare
Circuit City.
Well,
when it was around.
It's out of business now. They compare all the TV screens and then they go online to buy their favorite at Amazon for less money and no sales tax. Now, Amazon has nothing like the overhead of Best Buy, obviously. They are closing, and Best Buy is closing 50 more stores, reducing the sizes of others, creating tiny little quote-unquote mobile stores to concentrate on cell phones and reconfiguring some of their big stores to emphasize tech support and wireless. Is this a path for the future or rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, Michael? Big deal or big whoop?
Nearer, my God, to thee. Do you get the reference? That's what the orchestra was playing on the Titanic when it went down. It's a fable, a myth, but it's a nice one. So yes, they are rearranging the chairs on the Titanic. Yeah, they're like gigantic superstores devoted to tech support, to physical walk-in-the-store tech support. Great. Good luck with that. Sounds like a good plan.
Are you moving your stores to, you know, an international port such as the Philippines, you know, India, China? You know, isn't that where tech support is done these days?
Exactly. At least they're trying. They know something's, they know they're in desperate straits. They know it's not working and they're trying, but I don't think they've figured out a solution. They simply can't afford these gigantic superstores. Maybe they'll survive as a name brand with small mobile stores. But I don't see it happening.
At least they're being proactive. I mean,
yeah, they're trying, but they are right. Rearranging the deck chairs. And as far as DVD sales, they're not barely in that business anymore. They're about big appliances. They don't really care about music and DVD sales. If you go to the store, you see it takes up a small portion of the floor space.
Well, and there's something to be said for having a store where you can buy appliances. You still want to be able to go in and buy the appliance. And, you know, buying it online, you can do that, but you never know what you're going to get. And
well, that's why people go into the store to look. That's the whole problem. That's their dilemma. People do want to check out TVs and they don't want to buy it online without seeing them, but they walk into Best Buy, they look around, they figure, I like this screen. Oh, I don't like that screen. Oh, this is the best. And then they buy it online.
No, so I'm talking about like washing machines and refrigerators.
You know, same thing.
Well, yeah.
Same, I mean, people do that too. That's why Sears is in trouble.
I've never bought appliances online, like big appliances like that, because you know what? When it breaks down, I want to go and wring somebody's neck in a physical store.
Well, all right.
Yeah, that's right. Don't sell me any appliances, any bum appliances.
<I won't. laughs> No blenders for you.
That's right. Now, the Academy Awards will sound better than ever next year. You know why? Dolby, the company behind the famed sound system, is in talks to acquire the naming rights to the theater where the Oscars are held every year. It's currently known as the Kodak Theater, or if you're Billy Crystal, the Chapter 11 Theater. But since you use your phone to take pictures now and haven't developed a roll of film in a decade, Kodak is in a little bit of financial trouble, so they want their name back. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. You know, that's fine. They seem like a reasonable buyer. It's probably worth the $4 million a year, whatever they would pay. You know, gives them big exposure on the Oscars. Why not?
Well, here's the interesting thing to me. Part of the reason Kodak is in trouble is they were a big supplier of 35mm negative stock. So they would, you know, sell it to film productions and television productions. All of those are now going digital. And they would sell it to motion picture labs so that when, you know, Harry Potter gets printed on, you know, 3,000 prints to head out to the movie theaters, they would make all that money and provide all that stock.
Plus the consumer camera market collapsed.
Well, yes. So, yes, that is true. So what's interesting to me is, you know, effectively digital made Kodak obsolete in the motion picture space. And really, digital cinema has made Dolby obsolete to some degree in the digital cinema space. And what I mean by obsolete is their proprietary sound technology is obsolete. So now they're selling digital cinema servers, but everybody's selling a digital cinema server. So they've been pushed aside in the motion picture space, and yet they're thinking of putting their name on a theater that the Academy Awards, a big motion picture event, is held at.
So theaters used to have the Dolby symbol in their ads showing that they use Dolby technology for their sound system. That doesn't happen anymore?
Well, now, you know, with digital cinema, what the studio said was no proprietary sound technology, no DTS, no SDDS from Sony, no Dolby.
Everything, but I still see theaters with those symbols, don't I? Or do they drop those now?
They're pretty much dropping those. What you'll see is, you know, Real D, Master Image, all the 3D technology. The studios forgot to say no proprietary 3D technology.
Well, they didn't want to, did they?
No, they didn't.
But so that means theaters around the country are not paying Dolby to have their sound system anymore?
No, not at all.
But I mean, you're only looking at the film industry. What about music?
Yes,
and
no.
Stereos.
Okay, you're absolutely right. So where does Dolby make
Dolby, its... Is Dolby dead in consumer just like Kodak is?
No, I mean, Dolby makes Dolby DTS make their money from two places. One, licensing their codecs and their compression algorithms two studios, two mastering houses, so that, you know, when you're mastering a DVD, you can put DTS or Dolby Sound on the discs. Likewise, the consumer electronics manufacturers, like a Sony, like a Samsung, embed the decoders into their products, and so they pay, you know, 15 cents to DTS or Dolby for every television or every Blu-ray player that is made.
So obviously they've been hurt by the people going online and streaming MP3s from their computer rather than using a stereo system. You know, there's a lot more of people shoving their phone into a slot and playing it over speakers rather than the full CD stereo system. Are they involved in iPods or MP3 players or online Dolby technology at all, you know, via computers?
Yes, to some degree, although I have to say that's where I'm a little weak in my knowledge of what they're doing in that space. I know DTS is doing, you know, some work in that space as well. I'm not sure what it is.
So they could be a company with a fading technology, just like Kodak. So this could be the curse of the Oscar theater. Next 4 years from now, we'll have the Zeppelin company signing up for their Zeppelin Air technology will become the sponsors of the Oscars. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I mean, I don't think I don't think Dolby's going anywhere anytime soon. But I do find it interesting that, you know, Dolby has been marginalized in the motion picture space, not the consumer home electronics space, but in the motion picture space. And yet they're putting their name on a theater that is primarily known for a big motion picture award show.
I guess they think their big audience is not the motion picture industry, but the hundreds of millions of people who watch the Oscars.
That's true.
And hundreds of millions. That's an exaggeration, by the way.
Yes, possibly. Well, that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we're going to return to a story we discussed on episode 135, which was the SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, and the AFTRA merging. There was a vote held on Friday, and it looks like the two unions overwhelmingly agreed to join forces.
That's right. A SAG members voted, I think, like 82% in favor of the merger, and AFTRA voted 86% in favor of the merger. I first heard about it on a Twitter, of course. I think I got a tweet from Hollywood Reporter. But then I also saw tweets from actors who I happen to be following who were like, yes, we finally merged. Yes, it's happened. I think this is great. So, you know, actors were definitely very supportive of this.
Now, AFTRA stands for the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists and also includes broadcasters and newscasters. So now they're all under one large umbrella, and they didn't waste any time. Like, they merged immediately. The vote was held, and the 125,000 SAG members and the 70,000 AFTRA members are now in one large group.
Right. There's a lot of work to be done as far as flow and setting up offices and combining all their back rooms and all that sort of stuff. But yes, it is official right away. As I recall, SAG is a little more hard-nosed in negotiations, and some other people felt AFTRA was a little softer as far as like digital rights and the piece of pie that we're trying to fight for actors when it comes to streaming and online digital display and all that sort of stuff. So it'll be interesting to see how it works out politically when we see where the combined SAG-AFTRA is in negotiations, because they are now the 800-pound gorilla. Because before, as I think you said before, Sperling, people could play one off the other. If you don't get happy with SAG, you go to AFTRA. If you don't have AFTRA, you can say, well, fine, if you don't sign, we're going to go to SAG.
That's right. If you were in television and you couldn't cut a deal with SAG and you were trying to produce a sitcom, you'd go, okay, well, I'm really sorry about that, SAG. Listen, can you please get out of the way? I've got to deal with the AFTRA representative behind you. And now you can't do that.
Yeah, so it's going to be very – but will AFTRA weaken SAG and make it more compliant, or will SAG toughen AFTRA up, if that's, I think, the dynamic that was there, and make them a little more demonstrative in what they want and need? Because they want a piece of the digital pie. That's where everything is going to. Hulu and YouTube and streaming and digital downloads. That's where the future is. As you can see by apparently the slowing down in brick and mortar rentals of DVDs, that's where all the money is for syndication and all that. So they need that piece of the pie. And the studios keep telling them, no, we're not making any money. It's not working out. It's too soon.
Guess what? If you're not making any money there, then it won't matter how much, what percentage you give us, because you'll be out of business, because it's going to be the only business anyway.
That's right. So congrats to them. They're both very happy about it. And it'll be fascinating to see how it plays out in the next few years. I don't know when the next deadline is for a contract deal. I assume it's a year or two away at least.
I think so. I think at least 2 years away.
Yeah. So that'll be our first test of, what to see what happens with this.
Well, the deadline for our show is up. And if you want links to any of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, they can be found in our show notes on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you will find ways to subscribe to the show. You can subscribe in iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace or Stitcher or in a podcast catcher or your favorite RSS reader. Please do go to those podcast aggregators like iTunes and the Zoom Marketplace and rate, review us. It really does help us out. Our website, Showbiz Sandbox, is also where you will find ways to follow us on Twitter, where our username is Showbiz Sandbox. Or you can see if we've actually figured out how to fix our timeline on Facebook, where our username is also Showbiz Sandbox. You can email us. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Maybe somebody can fill us in on the legal ramifications of the Huffington Post lawsuit. Or you can leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can leave us a voicemail. Maybe we'll play it on a future episode. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com.
And they've just announced a few dates in North America. MGMT is playing the Oceaga Festival in Montreal, Canada in August. And they'll be at Music Fest in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, right near my brother, in August 5th. So check them out.
Now, Michael, where can we find you besides, apparently, the Huffington Post?
MichaelGiltz.com. And you can also find me a lot on Huffington.
Right. And so all of your writing can be found on MichaelGiltz.com.
Facebook. You can link to me on Facebook. You know, friend me on Facebook. Friend me on Twitter. There I am.
Michael needs some friends. You can find some of my writing on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.